It's Wednesday, the 30th of April, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, mulling over some of the top construction news stories from the past fortnight. Has there been much happening, Phil? I mean, I've been away on holiday, so I've been out of the loop, really.
Well, the big thing that's happened this week is the reminder of how fragile infrastructure can be. We haven't reported on it, but I think you could have heard about it everywhere else, that France and Portugal were plunged into darkness Portugal and Spain, bits of France, plunged into darkness on Monday.
Yeah.
And I still haven't read any informed explanation.
I don't think anybody knows what caused it.
I mean, maybe by the time people are listening to this, they'll know more than we do now. But it's quite, I mean, there's a former Ministry of Energy board or Power Industry board or someone wrote an article on the Spanish or Portuguese papers, I believe, blaming over-reliance on renewable energy, that wind turbines are too flaky and we need proper old-school energy. I'm sure there'll be people jumping on that bandwagon.
I'm sure there will. I mean, ironically, Portugal is where I was on holiday. Luckily, I managed to get away before all the lights went out, so I wasn't affected. But it was a close run thing. I was in Lisbon, and apparently everything just stopped.
Can't imagine anything worse than being stuck in a holiday airport electricity.
A good thing about Lisbon Airport is it's basically in the middle of the city. Well, it's in the city. You can get to it very, very quickly. So I could have just sort of got a bus back, I guess. But even so, it wouldn't have been much fun, I'm sure. Yeah, very strange times. And coming so soon after the blackout at Heathrow Airport, I'm sure that the conspiracy theorists are all over this. And I'm very tempted to join them and say, well, let's just go and ask Vladimir Putin what he's been doing.
Don't think I'll tell you.
It does smack of cyber interference of some sort, I think, but we'll find out in due course, I'm sure. But we're going to talk about rather more mundane issues.
Most
today.
Of what's been going on, the important stuff we've been reporting on, is really all to do with the passage of the planning infrastructure bill and everything that's going on in that side of things. But we thought we'd start off by talking about what you've been writing about in the latest issue of the magazine, Construction Index magazine, which lands on doormats probably this week or next week.
Yeah, it should be this week, I think. We do a feature in the magazine which we call The Lowdown, and the idea is that we provide... I nearly used the phrase idiot's guide, which is disrespectful to my readers because my readers aren't idiots, but if you like, a simple primer or sort of briefing.
Now, I'll tell you what it's like. Do you remember, I can't remember what they were called either, but when you were studying, a Shakespeare or a Thomas Hardy Dickens or something at school, and you had to write an essay on it, you could write cliff notes. Were they called cliff
notes?
That's
right, yes. Yeah, that's right.
It's told you how to write, answer the questions and write the essay. You didn't even need to read the plays.
I mean, the thing is that the whole purpose of the feature is sometimes it works better sometimes and other times. It depends who's writing it, because I should first of all say that it's never written by me. It's always written by somebody from the industry, somebody who's a specialist or even an expert in the particular topic, because the idea is to provide people with basic briefing on a topic which is usually quite complicated, often quite sort of dry and either technical or legal or legislative, but basically to give them the bare bones so that they can get to grips with it quite easily. So this is a very long-winded way of getting around to saying that I got somebody from the Mineral Products Association, Elaine Toogood, who's she's an architect and a senior director of concrete at the association. And, she's from the Concrete Centre. And she's written us a piece which is a lowdown on lower carbon concrete. And the reason I asked her to do this was because you will know this because you get the same press releases as me most of the time. We get an awful lot of publicity from people from the big cement producers and the aggregates materials companies, and also small startups all about saying, you know, we're developing or have developed a low carbon alternative to cement or some product or method which will reduce the carbon footprint of your concrete.
And they often say zero carbon because they've planted a tree somewhere.
Well, sometimes it's even negative. I have seen claims about negative carbon cement or concrete, which I think is probably stretching it a bit too far. But I'm sure that a lot of our listeners will be aware of this as well. Concrete, or rather, I should say, cement-containing or cementitious materials, cement-based materials, I think is probably the best phrase, because it sort of encompasses a lot of different things. We're talking mainly about concrete, I suppose. Concrete is the most widely consumed material, man-made material. Or is it? I'm trying to remember what the phrase is. I think it's the thing we consume most apart from water. Obviously, water is man-made. But it's a massive industry. The global cement industry is absolutely enormous. And a lot of people, I think, that will be familiar with the 8% figure, because everybody trots out this sort of perceived wisdom. The cement industry is responsible for 8% of all man-made carbon emissions.
Oh, I thought it was 7. I was trying to do some homework for this conversation.
Well, it's 1% between friends. I mean, it's an awful lot. I mean, when you consider just one single industry alone is responsible for, you know, 7 or 8, let's call it 10 percent of sort of man-made carbon emissions at a time when, of course, we're trying to reach net zero by 2050 and everybody is tearing their hair out and running around like headless chickens, wondering, you know, about what's going to happen if we don't reduce carbon emissions. So, as you can imagine, the construction industry, and specifically the concrete industry, want to get their carbon emissions down as quickly as possible. So, anyway, here we have it. I'm not going to summarize the article for you because it is too complicated. If you want to find out, if you want to get a lowdown, a quick 10-minute read, which will give you all you need to know about lower carbon concrete mixes, then you'll need to buy a copy of the magazine. But it's all in there. And it's interesting because a lot of the time people talk about cement substitutes without really specifically saying, you know, revealing what they're talking about. It's partly because of commercial confidence, I suppose. But you will know, Phil, and I'm sure a lot of people in the industry will know, that one of the ways you can reduce the carbon footprint of your concrete mix is to substitute another material for cement. You know, cement is obviously you burn limestone and it gives off CO2. That's the stuff that warms the planet. But if you can replace a lot of that cement with something else, then
like
obviously
coffee.
You can... last time we spoke, it was coffee, I think. But I think that is certainly on the wackier side of things. No, I mean, we're talking about these ground granulated blast furnace slag.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic phrase that trips off the tongue. It's a byproduct of steel manufacturing. And pulverized fuel ash, which of course is what's left after you've burnt coal to generate electricity. I mean, both of those things are really going out of fashion at the moment because, you know, we don't burn coal to generate electricity anymore. And as we discussed last time, there isn't an awful lot of primary virgin steel being produced in the UK, so there's not much GGBS being made. But anyway, there's still quite a lot of it sort of stockpiled in various places. But there are other ways of doing it as well, really arcane things. You can go down a real rabbit hole with this stuff. Well, why are we talking about this? Well, it's partly because we've got the lowdown article on it in the magazine, but also we've been receiving even more press releases recently about this. What is the latest one that you drew my attention to?
Well, this is from... It's not entirely clear.
You're telling me.
No one's put their name to it. However, it is promoting what used to be called Cambridge Electric Cement.
Oh, really? Oh, that's what it is.
And they've hang on. What have they done? They've changed their name to it. The new to me is that they don't call it Cambridge Electric Cement anymore. They call it Reclinker.
Right. Okay.
And this all is a spin out from the University of Cambridge research into cement and whatever. And I'm trying to find easiest explanation I can find for it. We first wrote about this in May 2022 on the Construction Index website. Three University of Cambridge academics have filed a patent and secured research funding for what they claim is the world's first ever zero-emission cement.
That's the stuff.
Other zero, net zero-emission cement. They're only that because they've offset somewhere. But what was Cambridge Electric cement, now Reclinker, is the real deal because of some. Their process begins with crushing and processing concrete demolition waste to sift out the old cement powder, which is then used instead of lime flux in steel recycling. As the steel melts, the flux forms a slag that floats on the liquid steel to protect it from oxygen in the air. Is this all relevant? After the recycled steel is tapped off the...
Oh, are you there?
I am. I started reading. I realized I was boring myself.
I didn't want to
on the poor listeners.
I think one of the interesting things about this, when I was looking into this and looking for somebody to write the lowdown for us before I stumbled upon Elaine, I didn't stumble upon her, obviously. I went to the Mineral Products Association begging for assistance with this, and she came to my assistance. But no, I found a very interesting a YouTube video by somebody who, it turns out, is pretty well known in the industry by people who, you know about these things. And she is Professor Karen Scrivener. And she works at an organization called, bear with me, it's called RILEM, but it's one of these acronyms which probably means something different in French, because it's the International Union of Laboratories and Experts in Construction Materials Systems. Sorry, Materials, Systems and Structures, which I've never heard of, but it sounds very important. And it's basically a sort of a webinar thing or a little piece about the myths of low carbon concrete, and it is fascinating. I mean, I would urge people, if they want to know about this, to actually go and watch this video, because we've already discussed how, you know, concrete and cement is so bad for the environment, 8% of global warming, carbon emissions and all the rest of it. Turns out that it's nothing of the sort. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if Professor Scrivener has an axe to grind here. She's clearly an expert and a highly respected specialist in the field. But one of the first myths that she seeks to dispel is that that cement is an energy-intensive material. She says, in actual fact, is nothing of the sort. And I will skip quickly to the... bear with me, folks.
I'm just going to interject while you find the bit you're looking for.
I did have it.
When you tipped me off, I watched this. It's from a series called Rock and Talk webinars.
That's right.
And it was fascinating. Well, the first half of it was fascinating. I got a bit lost in the science.
Yeah, it got a bit technical.
I looked her up because I certainly should have heard her. She was the editor-in-chief of the Cement and Concrete Research Journal for 15 years. She's a proper academic, a doctor in material science, Cambridge University, Imperial College, blah, blah, blah. But we know where she's coming from when she was a senior scientist and head of calcium aluminates for Lafarge in France. So she's absolutely from and embedded in the cement and concrete world.
Yeah.
And so you will always,
But I think the thing is that, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to cast aspersions at her academic credentials, because, as you say, she's clearly extremely well qualified.
But I bet you there's someone equally well qualified from the timber industry who
I'm sure.
Put a few bottles of wine on the table and let them at it.
Yeah, well, that'd be quite interesting, because she does take a pop at the timber industry at one point in a video. I've got absolutely no doubt that she could stand up, back up her claims in this video. But the one that really sticks, it very early on in the video, is this graph that she shows, which. It's a sort of a schematic which shows the relative carbon intensity of different materials. And cement-based materials, I must use that phrase, cement-based materials are actually one of the least carbon intensive materials, it turns out. Steel, aluminium, plastic, they're all far more carbon intensive. They're, you know, they kilogram per kilogram, they give out far more CO2 than cement, apparently. And which is fascinating. And she says the reason that cement is responsible for so much of man-made carbon emissions is because we just produce so much of it. It's just, you know, we produce massive quantities. It's, you know, mind-boggling, really. And so then she goes on to explain how, given that, you know, we need this stuff, what we've got to do is basically refine the way we design for it, the way we manufacture it, and the way we use it. And, you know, you can do so much with ingredients, and a lot of the publicity that you and I see, sort of week in, week out, is about, you know, the ingredients or the mixes or the way it's produced. That's just one element. I mean, you can use, I mean, she talks about ground granulated blast furnace slag, for example, you know, steel slag for short, which is great. You know, you can certainly reduce the carbon footprint of your concrete if you use this stuff. But as she says, it's a finite resource, and basically it's all being used anyway. So you can say, I'm going to increase the percentage of steel slag that I use in my concrete for this building, and you know, so I'm going to be really green, and I'm going to reduce my carbon footprint and all the rest of it. But the thing is, if you didn't use that steel slag, somebody else would. So by you taking more of it to put in your building, you're taking it away from somebody else. You're not actually making a net contribution to reducing global carbon emissions. So that was quite an interesting observation, I thought. There are other things, I mean, really quite arcane chemical things, like you can use seawater and you can use basalt for non-carbonated calcium sources like that, and you can use that to make your cement instead. But
some of the options you're saying get really expensive.
Extremely expensive. I mean, these things are clever and impressive, but they're really not practicable. It was so expensive that you couldn't really use it at all. What other things does she mention? Magnesium silicates.
You talked about the chart, the graph that she showed, showing cement, but more particularly concrete, as being one of the most actually carbon efficient products there is, contrary to its reputation, which is a real, you know, myth buster. But she also had another graph chart showing how different types of buildings, sort of embedded carbon, different types of buildings.
Oh, yes.
And how buildings made with a high concrete content, they appear both at the top end of the most carbonous buildings and the least, and the greenest.
Yes, yes.
There's a huge, great spread, depending on how it's used, depending on the mix, the thermal variety. And you simply don't get that sort of variety of you know, good to bad, if you like, with other materials.
No, that's right. And I think
if we look to bring the, you know, eliminate the bad concrete buildings and bring them all down to the level of the good concrete buildings, suddenly that shifts the whole balance, and concrete buildings become greener than steel or timber buildings.
Yeah, yeah. And which is quite a compelling argument, actually. I think one of the interesting things about that is that it shows you how much design can contribute to reducing the carbon intensity of a building, because she's saying, you know, don't use such long span beams. You know, you don't need to use so much concrete or so much cement or a stronger cement. You can stronger mixes rather. You know, you can design for a lower carbon building without really doing anything clever regarding the design of the mix so much as the design of the finished building.
I sort of tailed off when it got deep into the chemistry later on. But does she at all address the question of water, which is perhaps not a huge issue in much of the UK, but there are parts of the world where water is a very valuable finite resource, which would count against concrete over timber. But I suppose if they haven't got water, they probably haven't got many trees.
Probably haven't got any trees. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, no, she doesn't really. Again, I tailed off towards the end, but I think she doesn't really mention water and the role it has to play. I mean, I suppose there are a few places in the world where there isn't any water, and most of those places you probably don't want to build in. So I imagine that, you know, obviously it is an issue, especially in those places where water is precious. And
it's where we hold all the World Cups and Olympics these days.
Well, now. But no, I don't know. Presumably you have to burn more fossil fuels or, I don't know, probably solar energy in those places to desalinate seawater and use the water from that. I don't know. But no, it's not addressed specifically in this video.
But I think it's a neglected part of the concrete cement story, which does, I think, it's an ingredient which we just completely forget about.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It has a value.
Yeah, that is true. So, yeah, that was quite interesting.
She said she slagged off timber.
Well, sort of.
That's putting it unfairly, I suppose, than her. But she was sort of saying that how the myth is that timber is green and concrete is and cement are carbon intensive and dirty. She's saying to replace 25% of the cementitious material that is used in the world each year, it would require planting a forest 1.5 times the size of India.
Yeah. Well, if that's true, it ain't going to happen. As I've observed before, these issues are never simple. They're horribly complicated, and there's always a trade-off somewhere.
That's what engineering is. Engineering and politics are exactly the same. It's all about a trade-off.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're on to our next topic.
Oh, talking of politics.
Yeah.
Right, let's talk
about... And trade-offs.
Let's talk about the... we've talked about before about the planning and infrastructure bill that's going through the House of Commons at the moment. The committee stages have started. I haven't actually looked up these on the committee. I should do that. But already, part three of the bill, there is a lot of opposition mobilising against it. And we reported last week on a letter. We have a letter that was sent by the 40 signatories of the great and the good from the world of environmentalism, conservation, and ecology and so on, to every MP saying, please stop, think again. What's the actual last sentence? Please will you write to the Ministry of Housing to request a pause on part three of the Planning and Infrastructure Bill to allow for due process, proper consultation, impact assessment, blah, blah, blah. Now, what this is all about, the part three of the bill, we've talked about before, about how I've loosely described it as saying, instead of stopping work because you've found a newt, you can shoot the newt and plant a tree somewhere else. And it is what these ecologists are sort of saying. Other people are saying it's the polluter pays principle that's been well accepted for a long time. If you're going to, you know, pollute something, you need to clean it up. You break it, you pay for it.
Yeah.
Now this is changing that. It's saying to the extent it's talking about, instead of being polluter pays, it's pay to pollute. If you pay money, go ahead and pollute.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the principle of it. Okay, the money you pay will go clean up somewhere else, but it won't necessarily clean up the bit that you're, you know, the damage that you're doing. Other people have rather more dramatically killed this, they call this part of the bill, this legislation, license to kill.
Yeah. which is, well, I mean, it's
basically what it is.
It is basically what it is. Yeah. You can make a mess somewhere and then just say, well, I planted some trees.
And we absolutely understand how frustrating it is for the government and for the construction industry and for lots and lots of people that it takes years and years and years to get anything built because of all these environmental hoopla's and hurdles that have to be jumped and climbed. And you can see how a new government with 130 or whatever it is, an unassailable majority, say, sod it, we're going to railroad this legislation through. And there is an argument that says that we pay, and this is the Starmer Reeves argument, I've got a lot of sympathy for it, that yes, the environment's important, but we've gone too far in favour of the environment. You know, what's the point in all being vegetarian if we haven't got any vegetables?
Well,
is
I mean,
that analogy, does that work?
Well, I guess so. In a way, I don't know. It just doesn't feel to me like the sort of thing that a Labour government should be doing.
No, but they're desperate, and
they've gone
to industry and said, "What do we do?" And industry has said, "Here's a quick fix. Do this." And here's a new pair of spectacles and tickets to go see Taylor Swift.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we'll do that then.
Well, I mean, it's been established that, you know, the planning system is one of the things which is holding everything up.
Has it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's what Keir Starmer says. But, you know, if you say, well, you know, I'm going to remove this obstacle, I'm going to remove that obstacle, this is just another obstacle, isn't it?
Well, here's the argument from the other side, which I haven't sat on in the past before, but I'm becoming aware of it, and it's interesting. There are two lines to this. One, specifically about the license to kill bit.
Mm-hmm.
This letter from the ecologists and economists as well in this group, explaining why what they call the nature levy, this license to kill. The correct name is the nature levy. They say it's a blunt instrument that won't work. It rewards bad planning and penalises good practice. It'll add cost and delay to the planning and development process, they say. It imposes complex viability-based levies and creates overlapping and clashing regulatory regimes. Worse, it contains an inbuilt under-delivery mechanism, as the levy is adjusted downwards according to development viability. In other words, they're saying that it's not been thought through. It's another one of these bits of shooting from the hip legislation, which is going to be full of unforeseen consequences, just like the infrastructure levy that, you know, like Section 42 replacement, the community infrastructure levy, when that came in, that didn't work because it hadn't been thought through and it brought in all sorts of other complications. And they've got this the guy who did a review for the Treasury on the economics of biodiversity, Professor Sir Parthadath Gupta, he says it will cause economic harm, this bill, not just environmental harm,
economic harm as well.
And coupled with all to do with builders, not the blockers, in a separate story we ran, it's about how the government have put an amendment down to the planning infrastructure bill, to part three. Is it part three? I'm not sure. Anyway, to the bill, saying that they're going to simplify the planning by removing all statutory consultees from the National Significant Infrastructure Project process. In other words, when you, with these big infrastructure projects, as of whenever it was, I can't remember when it came in, which law it was that brought it in, but ever since we've had the planning inspectorate grant or recommending development consent orders, the whole development consent order process, which is meant to speed things up for infrastructure, as part of that process, as part of your development consent order application, which, remember, for the Lower Thames Crossing was the size of Canary Wharf, the pile of documents that they had to submit. It was absolutely humongous. Because they had to talk to so many people in a certain particular way, and the hoops had to jump through it for the consultation process. And the planning infrastructure bill, they've decided, bugger that, sod that. And to justify this, the government's saying, example of delays under the current system, Fens Reservoir had more than 1,000 days in pre-application because of consultation requirements. There's a National Grid job to put up 29 kilometres of overhead lines and underground cables. they had spent 717 days in pre-application consulting with all these statutory consultees. Hinkley Point C spent 3 years going through that process.
Yeah.
So it is hugely, you know, you think, yeah, let's get rid of that. Let's do it another way. We can, and so we're not getting rid of it entirely, but what we're proposing will cut it a lot.
So basically what they're saying is that they're going to reduce the number and the status of the people that they consult.
Yes.
So maybe your local MP would be consulted, but not your local parish councillor.
I think it's less than that. I think it stands to reason if you want to put up a tall building in London that with, you know, 100 metre deep or 30 metre deep foundations, that anyone with tube tunnels or gas pipes or whatever underneath the road, they need to know. So I don't think the MP necessarily needs to know. That's not important. It's the people who are actually physically affected, their assets, their property, you know, whatever.
But maybe Friends of the Earth don't need to know.
Well, sure, I'm sure they don't need to know. But there's that story quite recently about these people who woke up one morning and found the world's biggest warehouse right outside their back door.
Because
whoever it was had sent the letters advising them of the planning application going in to the wrong addresses. And so no one told them, and suddenly they've got no daylight. They've literally got this humongous great big shed, right? You know, an Amazon, I don't know if it's Amazon, but you know, and
humongous. Yeah, a great big warehouse, yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, this idea of removing the statutory consultees, arguments against it, Wildlife Trust, they say, actually, by talking to people before you start work, you get the experts with a different viewpoint to help you improve your proposals.
Mm-hmm.
Removing the opportunity, this is what the Wildlife Trust say, removing the opportunity for experts to improve proposals at an early stage could lead to badly designed infrastructure, which harms precious natural areas and destroy communities' much-loved green spaces. Having input and expertise early in the process is meant to nip project problems in the bud. Its removal will lead to badly planned, costly projects which run into trouble later on, causing economic damage to match the environmental harms. I think that's possibly overstating it, but there's an interesting point. That it's very easy to be, if your focus is we want to build a bridge over the Thames, you can have an utterly, utterly focused view. That's what we want to do. We're going to build a tunnel under the Thames. That's what we're going to do. And if no one actually tells you that the world's first leather-spotted dolphin has been spotted mating with a woolly mammoth, and this is like the world's never seen anything like it before. We need to, you know, make sure we look after these things. If they don't know about it, they don't know about it. They can't do anything about it.
No.
Now, whether we care so much about a particular breed of newt, I mean, emotionally, I'll wave placards for dolphins. I'm not sure I will for newts or millipedes, but. You know, that's just sentiment. A proper ecologist would care just as much about the newt and the millipede.
Mm. I wonder if it's a specifically British thing that we take, you know, we take these environmental things so seriously. I can't help thinking, what would the Chinese or the Russians do? Chinese particularly. I was reading about how many dams there are on the Yangtze River recently, and it's mind-boggling. And I think it was... Stalin, who said, I mean, we know how what an ecologist Stalin was, but apparently he said something which is quite interesting, which was that any river that reached the sea was a resource wasted.
So that's a fair point. I think a lot of civil engineers.
Well, that's why the Aral Sea doesn't exist anymore, because they took all the water out of the rivers feeding it, and there's no water left in it now. Obviously, we wouldn't go that far. There'd be, and I don't think anybody nowadays
would. We're builders, not blockers. I mean, it's all incremental. We might not go that far today.
No.
You know, today we'll just go so far. Tomorrow we might go a bit further.
It is an extreme. But,
But the development, I mean, the development consent order itself, that process is a slimmed down version of what came before, the whole public inquiry system. It's now a private inquiry, effectively.
Yeah.
And now we're going a little bit further and a little bit further, you know, removing that statutory consultee, removing that process.
It's
a slippery slope. That said, 3 years, talking to people for pre-application consultation is.
That's a long time.
A long time, even for a nuclear power station. Mind you, relative to the length of time it's taken to build a damn thing, it's probably about par. If you spend, what do they say? They do say you should spend as long planning something as you do building it to make sure that your plans are done.
Or measure twice, cut once.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
So, you know, 3 years think point maybe is about what it needs. Because it's going to take, what, about 20 years to build it, is it?
Oh, Hinkley Point?
Yeah.
I guess so. It must be nearly that.
It's been
that.
Going for long enough. And it's even when they finish building it, it probably won't be switched on for yonks afterwards, given what's been going on with, Flamanville and the other places.
Yeah.
Any other topics? Have we talked a lot? Talked enough?
There was another thing. You alerted me to this because it was quite interesting, talking about materials and energy conservation and, you know, the environment and stuff like that. Aerogel.
I'd never heard of it. Within the space of 2 minutes, I had some two completely separate... I checked to make sure they weren't the same organisation sending out the same thing twice. No, they're completely separate. Talking about one's got a... Well, both got new aerogel products.
Yeah. I mean, what surprised me, because I had heard of aerogel before, and it was one of those things which is a bit like unicorns. You can't really quite believe that they exist. And folks, obviously unicorns don't exist, but aerogel does. And if you've ever seen a photograph of it, it looks really weird because it's a solid, but it's 99% air. So it's like, you know, silica gel, that sort of those glossy beads that you
get. Sorry, I'm just getting my head around all those poor children listening to this. Tears now. They say, that horrible man next to be saying that Santa Claus doesn't exist.
Yeah, I don't think we've got that many kids listening to the podcast, Phil.
Sorry, aerogel.
But anyway, aerogel. It's been described quite graphically as frozen fog. And that's actually what it does look like. You can sort of see through it. But it's silica gel, which has had all the moisture taken out of it, all the liquid taken out of it, not necessarily water, I think. And you've got this incredibly very light... It's not a gel. When you think of a gel, you think of something squashy, don't you? Yes. And unless it's silica gel, which is like little glass beads, but this is the sort of gel we're talking about. But it's had sort of 99% of whatever was in there taken out, and you've just got this sort of skeleton of, I don't know what it is, silica probably, incredibly light, and
tiny pink pong balls?
No, it's not like that. It's like a sponge. It's more like a sponge. And, I have seen video of people like holding their hand over a gas torch or something like that with just a thin layer of this gel between the flame and their hand, and their hand doesn't get burnt. It's an incredibly efficient insulator, thermal insulator, and incredibly light as well. And it's been around for... Well, according to the BBC, which actually ran a story about this, nothing to do with the press releases that you recently received. This was this BBC story was actually a couple of years ago, talking about how aerogel can be used in the building industry because it's such a good insulator. It works even when it's in very, very thin layers. So if for retrofit, for example, we've got old cold houses and they all need to be brought up to modern standards of energy efficiency, you could do that more easily by using aerogel insulation because it's so thin and you can apply it to walls and doors and roofs and stuff like that without it actually being problematic, whereas if you're going to use something like mineral wool or polymer foam stuff, it's going to be much, much thicker, and that makes things more difficult. So it's very clever stuff. But yeah, as you say, it's remarkable coincidence that within literally 2 minutes into our inbox came two aerogel press releases from completely different people about their new insulation product. So I imagine that we're going to be hearing quite a lot about this stuff now because having not heard anything about it from the industry until now, all of a sudden you get two press releases. I think that clearly that's a a sign that this is something which is about to grab people's attention. Grabbed ours.
Well, because I'd never heard of it, I Googled it. And the first thing that comes up with, is it true that aerogel is more expensive than gold?
weight, probably.
I mean, it's expensive. It's an expensive option.
Yeah.
Which is why, I mean, the two products we wrote about today, one is sheets of the stuff that Armacell have made, new categories for ones for conditions up to 650 degrees centigrade. I mean, for really, really intensive heat. So it's for offshore industrial, for special applications. And the other one is for, huge range of heat, -200 to plus 200 or something.
Yeah.
It's a very, very specialist product, that one. And the other one, it's from a Northern Irish manufacturer called Energy Store. We've come up with injectable aerogel. You can squirt it into cavity walls. I think normally it's in sheets. You say it's like a sponge.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're saying it's the first time that you've been able to inject it. And because it is so effective, if you've got a really narrow cavity, you can squirt it in there. No mention of cost. I don't know whether you're going to have be very, very rich, or whether it'll be something open for everyone to use.
I suppose it's one of these things. They're probably economies of scale. I mean, if this did take off and everybody sort of decided to use it, then they'll be able to increase production and eventually the price would come down. But yeah, I think at the moment it is probably extremely expensive and I've no idea how it's made. They don't really give you any indication as to how it's made. And as I said earlier, I'd heard about this stuff, didn't quite really believe that it existed. But maybe I thought it was one of those things which I think, having seen YouTube videos about it probably a few years ago, it looked like, the old Tomorrow's World stuff on the television. This isn't reality yet, but it could be in future. All of a sudden, people are producing commercially available products made out of this stuff, which rather took me by surprise, because I just thought it was one of those things which somebody clever might have made in a laboratory somewhere, but there's absolutely no way you could produce it on a commercial basis.
Presumably, if it is too expensive, you can not water it down, but you can dilute it with something. So you can reduce its thermal values so that they're still good enough. It might not be as brilliant as, but it's not as expensive as. And therefore you make it half the price and half as good, but still good enough. Maybe that's a solution.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what's the other stuff? The carbon nanotubes. Haven't heard about those for a while, but they were big news a couple of years ago, weren't they? This was going to revolutionise the construction industry some way. I can't remember how. But there are all these technologies out there and all being developed, and presumably eventually there will be an application for them. And as far as aerogel is concerned, it looks like there already is.
And then we discover, not with aerogel, obviously, but with Wonder products, we then discover they give you lung disease some such. Wonder products need to be, but this is why we talk about construction industry being dreadfully sort of laggards and conservative and not being innovative enough. We should try new things, but when we do try new things, we get asbestos.
Yeah, precisely. Oh well.
On that note, it's going to be May next time we talk. We've got a bank holiday to look forward to this weekend. I normally get these things wrong, David. Do you know how often at the end of these podcasts I say, well, the clocks go back this week, folks.
And yeah, we made that mistake before.
Sorry, don't ignore me on my dates. But it will be May next time we're with you, because it's the last day of April today.
Yes, indeed.
So keep your dogs on the lead when you're going through fields of sheep, folks. That's my word of wisdom. And from another episode of Reconstruction, from David and myself, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.